You know, if someone asks you to make a piece of steel incredibly strong, like skyscraper holding, bridge suspending strong, your mind probably jumps straight to giant earth-shaking machinery.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is a very mechanical, heavy industry mindset. We assume that if we want extreme physical strength, we have to, apply extreme physical measures to just bend the metal to our will.
Yeah, we tend to picture towering blast furnaces or like massive hydraulic presses and pure, unadulterated industrial brute force.
Exactly.
But imagine trying to achieve that exact same extreme strength, not with a giant hydraulic press, but with a tiny, almost invisible chemical tweak.
Which sounds completely counterintuitive.
Totally. And imagine the alternative wasn't just a heavy press, but something completely absurd, like trying to use a 30 Tesla magnetic field on a factory floor.
Yeah, that is, I mean, just to put that in perspective for you listening, a standard hospital MRI machine, the kind that will rip a rogue earring right out of your earlobe, that operates at maybe 1.5 to 3 Tesla.
Oh, wow.
So a 30 Tesla magnet is just a monster.
Right. Using a military-grade magnet to make commercial steel is like, I don't know, using a laser cannon to light a birthday candle.
That's a great way to put it.
It's undeniably cool, but completely unscalable and honestly prohibitively expensive.
It is a phenomenal amount of magnetic force. And requiring that kind of equipment to mass produce construction steel is essentially impossible to justify economically.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are thrilled to have you here with us. The mission today for you listening is to explore how to get around an impossible industrial hurdle using a masterclass in elegant problem solving.
It really is an elegant solution.
Okay, let's unpack this because we are looking at a really fascinating materials science paper by Kei Wu and HKDH Padacia.
Right, published in Scriptum Materialia.
Yeah, and it's titled Extremely Fine Perlite by Continuous Cooling Transformation.
To truly appreciate what these researchers accomplished here, we really need to dig into the what and the why.
The mechanics of it.
Right. We are going to look at how an elegant atomic level tweak in the internal chemistry of steel can completely bypass the need for that giant 30 Tesla magnet.
Which is just wild to think about.
It is. We are basically talking about manipulating the fundamental thermodynamics of a material to force it to do something it naturally resists doing.
Okay, so let's set the stage with the metal itself. Before we get to the chemical hack, we really need to understand what this highly sought-after steel actually looks like under a microscope.
Well, we are dealing with a microstructural phase of steel called perlite.
Perlite, okay.
Yeah, you can visualize perlite like a microscopic layered pastry, like a millefeuille made of metal.
I love that visual, a metallic pastry.
Exactly. It consists of alternating layers of soft, ductile ferrite and hard, brittle cementite.
Right.
And a fundamental rule of thumb in material science is that if you make those alternating layers thinner and pack them closer together, what we call the interlamellar spacing, the steel gets significantly stronger.
So tighter layers mean stronger steel, but what is the actual mechanism there? Like, why do closer layers equal more strength?
It comes down to how metals actually fail or deform. Because when you bend a piece of metal, you aren't just stretching atoms apart.
What are you doing then?
You are moving microscopic defects, which we call dislocations, through the crystal lattice of the metal.
Okay, defects.
Think of a dislocation like a wrinkle in a rug. If you want to move the rug, it's so much easier to push the wrinkle from one side to the other than to just pull the whole heavy rug at once.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. So bending metal is basically pushing atomic wrinkles through the material.
Precisely. And those hard layers of cementite in the perlite, they act like speed bumps for those wrinkles.
Speed bumps. Okay.
Right. So when a dislocation hits a cementite layer, it gets stuck. If the cementite layers are far apart, the wrinkles can pick up momentum and slide relatively easily between them.
Meaning the metal bends easily.
Exactly. But if you pack those speed bumps incredibly close together, the dislocations just can't move. The metal becomes exceptionally rigid and strong.
Okay, so the goal is to pack those speed bumps as tightly as possible. And I guess that brings us to the original 30 Tesla headache.
It does.
Because researchers knew that if they took austenite, which is the high temperature phase of steel, and cooled it down at a continuous steady rate of 1 degree Celsius per second, they could theoretically get this superfine perlite.
Right, with an interlamellar spacing of like 50 to 100 nanometers.
But the metal wouldn't just do it on its own. It needed that massive magnetic shove.
Right, and we have to ask why that magnet was necessary to achieve those 50 nanometer layers. Because the magnetic field wasn't physically squishing the steel together.
It wasn't?
No, it was acting as a thermodynamic driving force.
Okay, break that down for us. When we say a thermodynamic driving force in the context of cooling metal, what is actually happening to the atoms?
Well, you can think of thermodynamics as the universe's tendency to seek the laziest, lowest energy state possible.
Naturally.
Right. So when steel is hot, the austenite phase is the lowest energy state. But as it cools down, austenite becomes unstable, and the ferrite and cementite phases become the new lowest energy state.
Okay.
The difference in energy between those two states is the driving force. It's like a ball resting at the top of a hill. The driving force is the gravity pulling it down into the valley.
But normally at 1 degree per second, the hill just isn't steep enough for the ball to roll down fast enough to form those ultra-tight layers.
That is exactly the issue. The transformation needs an extra push. Now, austenite is paramagnetic, meaning it doesn't care much about magnets at all.
Okay.
But ferrite and cementite are ferromagnetic. They respond really strongly to magnetic fields.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Yeah, by applying a massive 30 Tesla field, the researchers were essentially steepening the hill. They dramatically lowered the energy state of the ferromagnetic phases.
Which increases that thermodynamic driving force.
Exactly, forcing the transformation to happen with those incredibly tight 50 nanometer layers.
It's like tilting the entire landscape so the metal has literally no choice but to fall exactly into the microstructure you want.
Spot on.
But since building 30 Tesla magnets for commercial steel factories is a total non-starter, Wu and Badesia asked a brilliant lateral thinking question.
They really did.
They asked, could they recreate that exact same steep thermodynamic hill using internal chemistry instead of an external magnet?
Right. They theorized that by adding specific solutes to the steel, they could manipulate that energy landscape from the inside out.
And what did they add?
They turned to cobalt and aluminium.
Cobalt and aluminium.
Now, these two elements are typically used to produce a completely different high-strength steel structure called nanostructured bainite.
Okay, why?
Specifically because they suppress the formation of cementite. But here, the researchers wanted to use them to force the creation of perlite.
Wait a second. If cobalt and aluminium normally suppress cementite, why on earth would you use them to make perlite, which relies on cementite?
It is a really delicate balance. While they suppress cementite in certain temperature ranges, cobalt and aluminium also highly destabilize austenite.
Meaning what, exactly?
They raise the free energy of the austenite phase.
Mm.
So going back to our hill analogy, instead of lowering the valley with a magnet, cobalt and aluminium raise the top of the hill.
Oh.
Yeah. They make the austenite so energetically uncomfortable that it desperately wants to transform into ferrite and perlite.
So the metal wants to change all on its own just by sprinkling in the right atomic ingredients.
Exactly.
And it's vital to note for you listening that prior attempts to get this tight spacing without magnets were mostly dead ends.
Very true.
Some engineers tried plastically deforming the perlite, basically physically crushing it, but you can't crush a massive steel beam uniformly on a microscopic level.
No, that just doesn't scale.
Right. And others tried bumping up the carbon content to an extreme, like 1.5 to 1.8% by weight.
But pushing the carbon that high introduces a fatal structural flaw.
What happened?
Well, when you overload the steel with carbon, before the beautiful layered perlite can even form, you get significant quantities of what is called protectoid cementite.
Protectoid cementite. That sounds like something you definitely don't want in your load-bearing steel.
You certainly do not. Picture building a brick wall, but before you can lay the bricks properly, a thick, brittle layer of low-quality mortar solidifies irregularly along all the boundaries.
That sounds awful.
That is protectoid cementite. It forms a brittle, glass-like network along the grain boundaries of the steel.
So it just breaks.
Yeah. If you put any stress on the metal, it shatters along those boundaries. This new method with cobalt and aluminium aims to bypass all of that entirely.
No massive magnets, no uneven crushing, no brittle cementite network.
Just a clean, continuous phase transformation driven entirely by this internal chemical hack.
Okay, so the theory says the math should work. But, you know, theory is cheap. When you actually melt this down and put it to the test, does the metal obey?
Well, the researchers set up a highly precise metallurgical bake-off to find out.
A bake-off. Let's get into the setup.
So they created two distinct alloys to test the hypothesis. Alloy 1 is our heavy hitter, packed with 3.87 weight percent cobalt and 1.37 weight percent aluminium.
Okay. And Li2.
Li2 is the control. It has the same base carbon, silicon, and manganese, but it completely lacks the cobalt and aluminium.
Got it. So they took samples of both alloys and heated them up to 1,000 degrees Celsius for 10 minutes.
Right, inside a specialized machine called a Thermic Master Simulator.
The Thermic Master. Yeah. The goal there is to completely austenitize them, right? Resetting their internal crystal structure into a blank, high-temperature slate.
Exactly.
Then they started cooling them down at highly controlled rates, ranging from a creeping 0.02 degrees Celsius per second up to 2 degrees per second.
The Thermic Master is crucial here because it doesn't just control the cooling rate down to the hundredth of a degree. It continuously measures the metal using dilatometry.
Okay, let's explain dilatometry because it's not just a fancy thermometer. It's measuring the physical expansion and contraction of the metal, right?
Yes. Most materials simply shrink as they cool. But steel undergoes a phase change.
Right.
The crystal structure of austenite is close-packed, but the structure of ferrite is actually looser. So when the metal transforms from austenite to perlite, it physically expands for a moment, even while it's cooling down.
It essentially breathes outward.
Yes. And by measuring those microscopic hiccups in volume, the dilatometric data, the researchers can pinpoint the exact millisecond the phase transformation starts and stops.
Wait a second, hold on. That seems entirely backward to me.
How so?
Well, if I'm trying to freeze something in place before it has a chance to get, you know, chunky, my instinct is to pull it out of the furnace and drop it in an ice bath.
Right. Shot cool it.
Yeah. Shot cool it as fast as physically possible. Why on earth are they cooling it at a fraction of a degree per second?
Huh. Well, what's fascinating here is that the atomic architecture of steel completely rejects that intuitive approach. Yeah. The dilatometric data shows exactly why shot cooling fails. If you cool this specific alloy too fast, say, at 0.5 to 2 degrees Celsius per second, the carbon atoms simply do not have the time to diffuse and sort themselves into those alternating layers of ferrite and cementite.
Oh, so the carbon just gets trapped.
It gets violently trapped. The austenite lattice shears and collapses around the carbon before it can even move.
Wow.
And that creates a highly distorted needle-like microstructure called martensite.
And we don't want martensite.
Well, martensite is extremely hard. But it is also very brittle, and it's fundamentally a different beast than the tough, finely layered perlite they needed.
Okay.
They had to find a very specific Goldilocks zone, cooling slow enough to allow the carbon to sort itself into layers, but fast enough to ensure those layers are incredibly thin.
And the results of this cooling race showed just how effective the chemistry actually is.
They really do.
Because alloy 1, the one with the cobalt and aluminium, successfully transformed entirely into perlite at cooling rates all the way up to 0.1 degrees Celsius per second.
Which is a remarkably fast, continuous cooling rate to achieve a fully perlitic structure without triggering any of that brittle martensite.
Right. And alloy 2, the control without the special solutes, totally failed at that speed.
Yes. The dilatometry showed that at 0.1 degrees per second, alloy 2 just couldn't keep up and started forming that unwanted martensite.
So they had to slow it down even more.
To coax a fully perlitic structure out of alloy 2, they had to slow the cooling down to a painstaking 0.05 degrees per second.
Wow. So the cobalt and aluminium in alloy 1 destabilized the austenite so much that it forced the perlite transformation to happen even at that faster cooling rate?
Exactly. But the data revealed another layer to this that is extremely counterintuitive.
Hit me.
Alloy 1 actually managed to transform into perlite at a higher overall temperature than alloy 2.
Okay, that feels like a paradox.
Right.
Because normally, if a phase transformation happens at a higher temperature, the atoms have more thermal energy. They are vibrating and moving around more easily, which means they can travel further to form thicker, coarser layers.
That is the standard logic, yes.
A higher transformation temperature usually yields a weaker, wider structure.
You are absolutely correct. That is the fundamental thermal dynamic at play.
Yeah.
But this is exactly where the genius of the chemical hack shines.
Okay.
Alloy 1 transformed at a higher temperature, and yet it still produced a finer structure than the control.
Despite the heat.
Despite the heat. The thermodynamic driving force provided by the cobalt and aluminium, that massive internal push to change states, was so overwhelming that it just overpowered the natural thermal dynamics.
That is wild.
It forced the speed bumps to form close together, regardless of the higher temperature.
So they basically rewired the rules of the metal from the inside out.
They really did.
But taking a step back here, they won the cooling race, and the dilatometry showed the phase changes. But did they actually achieve the nanoscale architecture they were looking for?
That's the big question.
Because you can't exactly verify 50 nanometer spacing with a magnifying glass.
Not even close.
Yeah.
I mean, you are looking at structures that are a fraction of the width of a human hair. You need serious electron-level hardware to verify this.
And the lengths they went to just to see the results are grueling.
Oh, the sample prep is intense.
Yeah. To prep the samples, they took these tiny 3-millimeter-wide rods of the cooled steel. They sliced them into discs only 100 microns thick.
Which is incredibly thin already.
Right. But then they physically ground those down to 50 microns.
It doesn't stop there.
No. To finish, they electropolished these fragile, paper-thin metal discs using a highly reactive mixture of perchloric acid, glycerol, and methanol.
Carefully stripping away atoms.
Literally until the metal was thin enough for a beam of electrons to pass straight through it.
It is such a painstaking process.
Yeah.
I mean, a single microsecond too long in the perchloric acid and the sample just dissolves entirely.
Ah, gone.
Exactly. Mm. But when they finally capture those images, the visual evidence backed up the thermodynamic theory perfectly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. When they measured the spacing of those microscopic speed bumps under the transmission electron microscope, the data was stunning.
Truly.
Alloy 1 achieved an incredibly tight spacing ranging from 44 to 96 nanometers, with many of those spaces hitting exactly 50 nanometers.
So they replicated the impossible 30 Tesla magnet result entirely through internal chemistry.
Yes. And Alloy 2, the control, was significantly coarser, maxing out between 80 to 128 nanometers.
So the cobalt and aluminium did exactly what the thermodynamics predicted.
Exactly. And the final proof comes down to the Vickers hardness test.
Right, where they take a diamond indenter, push it into the metal with a specific force, and measure the microscopic dent it leaves behind.
Yeah, and Alloy 1 peaked around 422 on the Vickers scale for the samples with that 50 nanometer spacing.
Which is very impressive. But honestly, the raw numbers aren't even the best part.
What's the best part?
The most revealing detail is how the hardness correlates to the spacing. When you take the hardness data for both alloys, and you plot that hardness on a graph against the inverse of the interlamellar spacing.
A metric we call S to the negative one.
Right, S to the negative one. Every single data point from both the control alloy and the hacked alloy falls on the exact same perfectly straight line.
Wait, finding a perfectly straight line in physical metallurgy feels a bit suspicious.
It's definitely rare.
Usually, real-world physical data is super messy. Why is this line so perfect, and why does the paper make such a big deal out of it?
It matters because of the mechanism of strength we talked about earlier.
Mm.
In material science, researchers often analyze the strength of metals using something called the Hall-Petch relationship.
Okay, Hall-Petch.
And Hall-Petch plots hardness against S to the negative one-half. So the inverse square root of the spacing.
And what does that inverse square root actually represent physically?
Well, Hall-Petch assumes that the dislocations, the wrinkles in the rug, are moving through a wide open space and then piling up in a massive traffic jam against a solid wall, like a grain boundary.
A traffic jam of wrinkles.
Yeah. And the math of that massive pileup gives you the square root relationship. But the authors specifically point out that using Hall-Petch for this ultrafine perlite is mechanistically wrong.
Because the layers are so incredibly thin, there isn't enough room for a massive traffic jam to even form in the first place.
Exactly. The speed bumps are so tightly packed that the dislocations interact with the boundaries singularly, one-on-one, rather than in giant pileups.
That makes total sense.
And by proving that the hardness falls perfectly on the linear S to the negative one line, the authors proved that the massive strength of this steel comes purely from the simple linear shrinking of the space between those cementite layers.
The chemistry allowed them to shrink the spacing, and shrinking the spacing directly created the extreme hardness.
It is a beautifully clean result.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this deep dive? Beyond the fact that material scientists can now brew super strong steel without needing a magnet the size of an office building.
Right. What's the takeaway?
For me, this is a profound masterclass in problem solving. It demonstrates that when you are faced with an insurmountable, budget-destroying physical barrier, the answer isn't always brute force.
You don't have to build a bigger machine to force nature into submission.
Exactly. Sometimes the most incredible innovations come from stepping back, understanding the deep internal mechanics of the system, and letting the natural laws of thermodynamics do the heavy lifting for you.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, It really reinforces that true scientific advancement lies in continuously challenging assumptions.
Yes.
Because the entire metallurgical industry assumed that achieving an extremely fine, undeformed microstructure required either massive physical crushing, brittle carbon levels, or extreme magnetic fields.
But this paper proves them wrong.
It proves that those exact same structures can be coaxed out of the steel with a slow, continuous cooling process if you just understand how to manipulate the atomic energy landscape.
Working smarter, on a molecular level.
Precisely.
And at the very end of the paper, the authors drop a fascinating little breadcrumb about where they are going next.
Oh, I love this part.
They mention that they want to study how these specific solutes, the cobalt and aluminium, partition during the transformation.
Essentially, they want to freeze the metal mid-transformation to see exactly where those individual atoms distribute themselves along the moving boundary between the austenite and the perlite.
Which leaves us with a wild thought for you to mull over as you go about your day. What if the key to the next great technological revolution isn't just about what bulk ingredients we dump into the pot, but understanding exactly where every single individual atom decides to park itself in the split second a material cools down?
It is a frontier that fundamentally changes how we think about building the world around us.
It really is. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking questions, keep looking past the brute force solutions, and keep exploring. Catch you next time.